This is Dick Hain, and title of the session is Grassroots Activism, Bread for the World. And having extemporaneously said what I just said, I better hasten to try to make a distinction for you. And I know it's going to be real hard to make. And I've kind of been wrestling with this and what to do about it. And the distinction is, when I'm speaking as Dick Hain, and when I'm speaking as Bread for the World, so I'm here in an official kind of capacity, a role. And the distinction's very, very important. Because when I talk about political spirituality, and my little extemporaneous remark a moment ago, when I talk about political spirituality, and when I talk about theology, I am speaking only as Dick Hain. I am not speaking for Bread for the World. Okay. Bread for the World has no orthodox theology. That is, there is no one theological position that is Bread for the World. And that's a good thing, I think, because you know, I do homilies at Catholic masses. I preach in Lutheran churches, Presbyterian, Methodist. Occasionally, you know, I do presentations in Baptist churches and AME Zion and a whole range of different denominations. And so it's a good thing that we don't have just one theological perspective. And I think it's very interesting that people who are united in their theology, I think it tells us a whole lot, people who are united in their theology and liturgies are divided over social questions. And people who are united around social questions are divided in those other things. And I just think that's kind of an interesting thing. When I go into a community to speak, you know, there'll be people there who represent all those various traditions and more. But we have 30 or 40 different denominations, and about a fourth of our members, they don't ever write down and send in exactly what they are. So we don't even know what denomination they are. So I just think that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. But there's actually another reason why I'm trying to make this distinction between Dick Hain, Bread for the World organizer, and Dick Hain, who's going to talk a little bit about political spirituality and theology. I have been debating, you know, whether to speak my heart and mind on that latter topic or not. And if I do, I will say some things that will be fairly outrageous and will counter some of the things that you may hold dear. And I can't afford to lose any political allies over my own individual outrageous theological notions, okay? So if I say something that you find theologically or spiritually really offensive and dead wrong, just say, well, you know, that's just his kind of quirky theology, and that's okay. The important thing is, are we together on hunger issues, okay? So wanted to try and make that a bit clear at the beginning. Let me tell you just a little bit about my background and how I got into some of this. And then I'm going to show a videotape, and then we'll have some discussion. I started out Western Pennsylvania, Lutheran College and Seminary. Served a parish, mission parish in Maine for 3 years. And that was about the time the civil rights movement was becoming fresh in the public view. It had been going on ever since there had been slaves in America, but at various times we were more or less conscious of it in the white community. And so a lot was going on. That was the early 60s, okay? I'm talking about the years, if you have your own reference points for those years, 62 to 65. And I was pretty appalled that I had gotten all the way through, you know, high school, college, seminary, And somehow nobody had bothered to point out very clearly that there was a thing called racism in American society. It seemed like that was a kind of fundamental flaw in my education. And so I went to, in 65, went to the University of Chicago and spent 5 years there working on a degree in social ethics. My doctoral advisor was Al Pitcher, resident scholar here. And I remember very clearly the first class I had with Pitcher. He was real busy at that time with Operation Breadbasket and with Jesse Jackson. That is, he was doing more doing than he was teaching or preparing for teaching. But I remember very clearly an early class in church and politics in which he sat there and sort of muttered to himself. We were sitting there, but it was sort of as though he was only half conscious of our being there. And he said, you know, there ought to be some way to get people, you know, involved in some way that they really learn how to be activists. I mean, how can you do that in a classroom? Okay, classrooms do not generally create activists. And I'm going to have a lot to say about that, or at least a few very pointed things to say about that tomorrow. And that question kind of stuck with me. You know, how can you get people interested in being activists? Then in the early 70s, in 1970, I went to teach in seminary at Bright Divinity. It's a small to middle-sized seminary at Texas Christian University. Related to the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. And in the course of things, discovered I had a neighbor by the name of John Howard Griffin. Now, most of you probably don't know John Howard Griffin, but you may recognize the title of one of the books he wrote, Black Like Me. Griffin was the journalist who had colored his skin black and traveled in the South. And it was a very powerful book because most white people weren't ready to hear black people. It's kind of one of those strange kind of things. They were ready to listen to a white person who turned his skin black, but they weren't really ready to listen to black people. Nonetheless, the book served an important function for a lot of people and helped people kind of see things somewhat from a black perspective. So I invited Griffin to come talk to one of my classes. And a student asked him, how did you get involved in doing this? What motivated you? What led you to do this? And fortunately, somebody had a tape recorder running, and his answer was this. He said, I was born of an old Southern fundamentalist family from Georgia. I had the kind of upbringing that society gave us in those early years, which gave us the illusion that we didn't have a prejudiced bone in our body. We barely learned to hate. I was very unhappy with the educational system in this country, and when I was 16, I went to France. I was there until France fell. So now we're talking, 1940, something like 41, somewhere in there. I was in the French underground smuggling Jewish people out of Germany from 1939 to 1940. And that was, of course, the first real awakening that I had to what racism was all about. It was a devastating shock to me to find that our preoccupation with the Hitler rationale had been merely intellectual. I'm ashamed to say that I made no connection between the reasoning we did where Jewish people were the victim group and the same kind of reasoning I had been brought up with concerning a different victim group, black people. And he goes on about that a bit. I'm going to skip a few things. But they were smuggling people out of Germany and putting them onto boats in England. And there were only two people in that area doing that. And a time came when you had to have special papers to show at certain checkpoints, and they didn't have any way to make papers. So So he says, I was only one of two people in that area, and it was my task for this particular night to go and tell some people that we were not going to succeed. It was going into those rooms where we had them hidden that the whole thing, which has haunted me ever since in my work in this country, hit me square in the face. I went into the rooms where the mothers and fathers and children were hidden. I didn't have to tell a single one of those families they were not going to succeed. They told me it was all over. They said the first thing the Germans would do is round them up and ship them back to Germany. Then they asked me to do a heartbreaking thing. They asked me to take their children because we could move children under the age of 15. And suddenly you were sitting in those rooms and you be, he switches into the present tense at this point in his thought. There's a lot of stuff in here, a lot of metaphor, a lot of nuance. And suddenly you were sitting in those rooms and you became aware of the fact that there are only two people in the world that know who was in those rooms, myself and my teammate. Suddenly all this intellectual preoccupation we had was simply washed away because we were in the presence of a massive human tragedy. The tragedy of parents who loved their children and were giving their children away to someone they hardly knew so at least the children could escape the camp. And I realized I could go outside of those rooms and I could go a block in any direction and could find a person who considered himself perfectly decent who had no idea of the reality in those rooms. That person might begin to rationalize and even justify the racism which led to the tragedy inside of those rooms. And then he goes on to relate that to his experience in the South in the United States. One instance was where an 8-year-old child had a rope thrown at her by some men who were trying to frighten her. It was thrown around her neck and she was dragged 2 blocks behind this car. And he says, when I was in these homes with black people in the South, I was right back in those same kinds of rooms, rooms that were filled with grief-torn human beings. And when you go outside those rooms, you know that you can encounter people everywhere who consider themselves decent and who would go right on rationalizing the racism which led to the tragedy inside those rooms. Well, that was the hook. I decided if that's what got Griffin going, and his experience was very powerful, what got other people going? So I interviewed a bunch of people, some who worked in defense industries, some who were full-time urban ministries and activists, a few people whose names are nationally known that you would know if I could tell who they were, and as a result wrote a book, Up From Apathy, which came out a few years back, and it was something short of a bestseller. And this explored why is it people become, what leads people to become socially and politically involved? But the other part I want to pull from that is right at the end, the very last pages, page and a half of the book. I talked to Griffin while I was doing the research, and he says, you want to know why people get involved? He says, I'll tell you why. The roots lie in religion. And indeed, late in life, he had been working on a biography of Thomas Merton, which was subsequently published with pictures. John Howard Griffin was also a photographer. He was essentially a journalist. You may have seen his Merton thing.
I didn't know that was the same guy. Black Like Me. Huh.
Yeah, same guy as Black Like Me, yeah. He died not long after that, and the book, I believe, was published posthumously, or just about the time he died. My experience when I talked to people was, if by religion one means identifiable church or synagogue, the evidence in the interviews is mixed. A lot of the people I interviewed said they didn't go to church, they wouldn't go to church, that the church was immoral, that the church was racist, that they found their meaning, their community of meaning, among people who were working for justice. And that's essentially what I'm going to say for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to try and draw out political spirituality as a community of meaning for those who are involved in justice practice. And say a little more, I hope, than just that one sentence. And there were other people who felt that their commitment to justice was profoundly grounded in, you know, the church, in a biblical tradition, in a and an identifiable religious tradition. But my conclusion was that the ultimate concern for people is a religious commitment. Ultimate concern for people is a religious commitment. And my feeling is, and this is Dick Haint, okay, this is not Bread for the World, that church, seminary, and graduate school rather largely get in the way of that rather than facilitate that. I'll do my little critique tomorrow. I'll put my neck on the line tomorrow. I didn't think that was a good thing to start with. I have to get psyched up for it, and you have to accept me a bit first. What I'm going to do this week, I'm going to be here 2 weeks. Tomorrow I'm going to say more about what I mean by political spirituality. And then at the end of the session, we're going to talk a little bit about WIC. The Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Feeding Program. 50,000 women and infants are being cut off the program right now. We're going to try to find time to write a letter. I'll write a sample letter for you. And I've got a book that shows who your member of Congress is. If you don't know, don't be embarrassed. I think for 5 years I sent letters. I lived near a line between two congressional districts, and I sent my letters to the wrong member of Congress. And I'm supposed to know about these things, you know. That was when I was teaching in seminary. So I have a little book with maps and pictures of your representatives and your senators. If you don't know your representative, you probably know one of your senators. And so, we can track that down fairly quickly. Wednesday, I want to claim that public policy is a spiritual discipline. We talk about spiritual disciplines in retreat. I want to talk about spiritual disciplines in advance or in practice or in doing. That public policy, the discipline of sitting down and studying issues and bothering to write a letter, is a pain in the you-know-where. But nonetheless, it is a spiritual discipline. And so we'll talk about the peace dividend and the budget process this year, and I'll try to give you some sense of where I think that's going, at least in this budget year. And we'll write letters on the Harvest of Peace resolution, which Bread for the World has written, found members of Congress to sponsor. It's working its way into the congressional process now, and we're trying to get passed, try to get a floor vote in September. Friday, I want to talk about the spirituality of American culture. I say I want to talk. I don't just want to talk. I'll probably do more talking today than the rest of the sessions, just kind of getting going here. But I want to hear what you think the spirituality of American culture is, and I think I have some opinions about what the spirituality of American culture is. And as an issue, we'll talk for a little bit about food stamps and the Mickey Leland Hunger Relief Act. Mickey Leland, congressman from Houston, died in Africa in a plane crash. Tragic loss, friend of Bread for the World, friend of the poor. Black member of Congress, of which there are not just holdings out to begin with. And Saturday, I'm going to talk about spirituality and interpersonal relations. That is to say, to telescope it just a bit. I think people get more out of a baptism when the baby cries than the baby gets out of the baptism, okay? That is to say, people love it when that little spark of humanity cuts through all the rest of that stuff and lives. So I think that we miss the fact that there is an enormous amount of spirituality occurs in our, we go looking for it in other places, and it's right here, it's right here. And if we have time, and I hunch we aren't going to get the third world debt. I mean, who's going to want to talk about third world debt if you can talk about the spirituality of interpersonal relationships? But third world debt is one of the most important public policy issues going on today. It's eating people alive, quite literally. So with that as a kind of prologue, I want to show you a videotape. Some of you may have seen it. And now we move into the bread for the world part. I guess I would hold it before you get spiritual, you've got to get down and dirty material. And you got to crawl down into the muck of politics, and you got to thrash around, and you got to live with ambiguity and uncertainty, no neat systems, no certainty of where it's going to come out, and you just get down there in the muck with all kinds of strange people and do what you can. And the videotape tells you a little bit about what Bread for the World is, what it does, and how you can get involved. And as I said to some folks last night, I work Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska. I want to come to your church, and I won't say all this political spirituality stuff that'll get people upset. I understand the setting I'm in. I know how to put things in the same kind of things in terms that people will feel okay about. And if I come to your church, I might show this videotape, or I can send you one. You can show it yourself.
Lights off?
Well, could.
Right behind you, right over there,
and
if you want to hit them.
It actually shows pretty well, but I don't know what that white line is. May have to do some tracking stuff.
Together as Christian brothers and sisters across a very broad range of denominations has a special appeal to me.
No one person can do anything. But when you join together and put your expertise together, then that's when you become effective.
It was always so lonely to feel like am I the only person that's really concerned about these issues. And I could come to a bread meeting and find out, no, other people are concerned. This is something that other people are working about. And it was a real shot in the arm.
Bread for the World is a nonpartisan Christian citizens movement against hunger. Since 1974, Bread for the World has been mobilizing individuals and churches to lobby for legislation that helps hungry people at home and around the world.
We thank you for this group of people gathered here tonight.
Here in Atlanta, as in some 400 local chapters across the country, Bread members join together to discuss strategy.
In the story of the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus says, "You give them something to eat." That's a sentence that's very powerful, speaks to my mission and my understanding and my calling into the Christian life. And we in America are so richly blessed.
It's not just a matter of feeding the hungry person, it's a matter of changing the systems that create hunger. And I see this as an approach to bring about that kind of change.
Food and nutrition programs can be sold as something that saves us tax dollars. Every dollar spent on the WIC program has been shown to save $3 in health care costs for premature infants and their mothers. And so it's marketable.
The basic thing is that you can change things, you can save lives, you can feed hungry people by just writing letters or making phone calls or helping your organization any way you can. And the best part about it is they tell you how.
I say everyone counts. And oftentimes you underestimate the value that one person can bring. Sometimes all it takes is one person to be a catalyst for something. And even though the problem may seem enormous, everything has to start somewhere. We live in a democracy, and we have an opportunity to make life better for other people. We are part of the government. We can raise our voice on behalf of hungry people. And if we do that, we can make a difference. Public policy has an enormous effect in determining whether people eat or die.
And I believe there was a meeting with Tribble down in
One of the fundamental ways Bread for the World members participate is through writing personal letters to Congress.
Maybe another way to address it, too, is to focus on the hunger aspect in relation to...
Writing a letter really takes so little effort. The hardest part is overcoming the initial inertia. And in a group like this, you really have the incentive to get the job done, and it's very gratifying.
So why don't we just take a few minutes, we are going to run a few minutes past 9, take a few minutes and just write a brief letter, and then we can send it out tonight.
When I write a letter, I feel like I'm having influence, and that, from a selfish point of view, perhaps makes me feel good. I think also the act of writing a letter sort of commits you personally to a particular piece of legislation. You become interested in it, you begin to watch it, you watch its progress or lack thereof.
One legislator told us that if they get 10 letters on a particular issue, that automatically puts a staff aide to work on that issue, no matter what the issue is.
I feel that even if I write a letter to Congress and the issue doesn't pass, I still feel like I've made a difference. I feel like I've raised awareness about the issue, and I know that I did my best and I learned more about the issue in the process.
Bread for the World also coordinates letter writing campaigns at churches nationwide in an annual offering of letters supporting specific pieces of legislation.
I know that so many times when I've heard about world hunger and disease, I have felt helpless as an individual to do anything about these problems. And that's something that's wonderful about what we're doing today, because we have the chance as citizens to write our representatives and let them know that we're concerned about children's health in other countries, not just in our own. And we have the chance to affect the policy making in our country through expressing our opinions.
Bread for the World demonstrated the power of letter writing with its campaign in the Child Survival Fund, which contributes to the international effort to save the lives of children from hunger-related diseases.
We have policy analysts on staff who developed the legislation for child survival. Went in as a proposal as part of the foreign aid package back in 1984. The letters went into Congress on child survival, and Congress did establish that fund and voted an initial $25 million for it. We had asked for 50, we got 25. Well, that's half a loaf, and that's the way you make progress.
Over the next few years, Bread helped increase the level of funding to $100 million.
Now, the key question is, what does $100 million mean in terms of real live human beings? Well, when we first proposed the legislation, Jim Grant, the director of UNICEF, told me that for every $100 spent on child survival, they estimate that at least one child's life is saved. If you apply that formula to the $100 million that Congress voted for fiscal year 1989, you're talking about 1 million kids who will live rather than die just from 1 year's funding alone. That's 25 children for every Bread for the World member.
Children have a right to survive, to grow in health, and to be protected and nurtured in their growth to full potential. And you and the Bread for the World on this front, as well as many other fronts, are contributing to making a real difference. keep up your work, and thank you.
Solutions to affordable food, like the Emergency Food Reserve Bill Brett drafted and shepherded through Congress. This reserve ensures that millions can be fed in time of famine. Bread for the World is successful because it supports legislation that is attainable. They research the issues, draft legislation, and work with Congress to gain its support.
Bread for the World has been about the business of trying to provide information to policymakers about hunger around the world, and they've been tremendously effective in helping to raise the level of awareness of public policymakers here in the U.S. Congress.
Bread used its winning formula to gather support for the WIC program, helping women, infants, and children who are nutritionally at risk.
1 out of 4 children who are born now are born into families with incomes below poverty. Poverty and low birth weight seem to go hand in hand. The WIC program is extremely important in helping to prevent low birth weight, reaching pregnant women early in the pregnancy so that they'll have adequate nutrition during that time. Also, the WIC program is quite an adjunct to health care generally.
Well, we have been seeing more pregnant women coming in that we had not been able to serve because we had to put them on what we call a waiting list, which means that once we got additional funds, then we'd be able to serve, and babies don't wait. And so our concern was that, you know, we need to have it immediately because Georgia in particular had one of the highest infant mortality rates in the nation. And in order to reduce that, we needed a program like WIC.
Let me tell you about Bread for the World's work on the WIC program, the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Feeding Program, one of the best food assistance programs. During 1987 and 1988, at a time when Congress was cutting everything back, the letters came in, we were able to get Congress to increase funding for that program by $133 million a year. Divided by the number of Bread for the World members means on average each member's activity generated support for that program to the level of $3,325. And I think the end result, which is probably not apparent at the moment, will be that there will be a lot of healthier infants around that will not have to have medical care and all the things that go along with malnutrition at a later age.
I think that this is a message that Bread for the World is trying to convey to members of Congress, that you can really have it both ways. You can save lives, you can have healthy babies, and at the same time, you can save very substantial amounts of money to the federal treasury.
Thanks for calling Bread for the World's Legislative Update Line. This is Larry Holler.
What's the week doing on a Friday afternoon after the legislative week is over? I record the update, 3 minutes in length, and then any Bread for the World member who would like to can call in.
Aside from the update line, Bread keeps its members informed through newsletters and targeted mailings.
It does a very good job of providing first-class information on issues in a way that that people can take that and use that to be in touch with their legislators in a very effective way.
Working through national and local media, Bread has been effective in making its voice heard on legislative initiatives. Members have played an important role.
My Bread for the World local group is very active in writing letters to the editor on hunger issues because media coverage is an important legislative tool and it's effective in accomplishing legislative results. Elected officials monitor closely the local media for any references to their names because they recognize the power of the media during re-election campaigns. They're usually responsive to the suggestions and opinions that we send in on hunger issues.
Members can also get actively involved through the Legislative Quick Line.
What we've tried to do is to get in every congressional district our local groups to put together a telephone tree. That's what the quick line is, where we call one person, that person calls two, they call four, they call eight, until the message gets out to all our members.
Hello, Claire Brown. This is Susan Horst.
There was a case just this spring where a bill came up for a vote in a subcommittee, and we were asking for $150 million per WIC, and the subcommittee voted only $48 million. We went back the next day with another quick line message to the full committee and urged them to increase it, and that full committee increased that amount to $89 million, more than the House had voted. And it was obviously as a result of those calls they made over the weekend.
Alternative proposals would be...
Another way BREAD members participate is through forums and workshops on critical issues.
We're going to focus them on all of the states that are in, or all of the nations that are in Southern Africa, and there are nine of them. We've got a map up so that we can reference these as we go through our discussions.
One of the things that Bread for the World is beginning to do, along with others, is to look at the root causes, some of the structural causes. And what we would hold up is that militarization certainly is one of the primary causes of famine in Africa.
When I got into Bread for the World is when I discovered that it had such an international scope. I was just really thrilled that some organization was concerned about the plight of small people everywhere, and not just national issues.
Well, the moment has arrived. Welcome to Capitol Hill. Welcome to our rally on Capitol Hill and your day of lobbying. This is undoubtedly one of the highlights of your time here. At least I hope it is.
Some BREAD members are able to come to Washington, D.C. to visit their representatives in Congress.
How do you do? Yes, indeed. How are you, Karen? Fine. Come on in.
Bill 2378 is much stronger, and we're here to support that and talk to you about that.
Well, this is the first time to be here on the Hill. I think what the organization has helped me do is be informed so I can have the initial courage to go in there and say what I had to say.
We have confirmation today that we will be having several congressmen with us.
Just come on over. The worst happens to be on the floor.
You have an excellent reputation, all of you, particularly with those members like myself who have worked closely with you over the years. That reputation came about because of the committed people who are Bread for the World and because of your intelligent approach to legislation.
Some of the lobbying groups rate Bread's lobby in Washington is one of the most effective. And of course, I think it's only as effective as we members throughout the country make it. The strength is in the numbers. And you get a lot more done that way, and you're effective if you're stronger and, you know, there's more of you.
We have the ability to provide for the basic needs of everyone. And with the ability being there, I think there's just no excuse for us not making that happen.
Well, if you have a conscience that tells you that something's not right in the world, when you see hungry people, homeless people, and you feel a sense of aching about it, and you don't know what to do. You want to do something, but you have no idea, you're just one person. Look into Bread for the World and find out what you can do.
Something just told me that if I was going to get involved in anything, maybe it would be this. Because everything else is just sending checks through the mail. And I felt that there should be one thing that I would get personally involved in. And this is it.
Bread for the World, as I said, has been effective. It gets information out to people and allows people to make an intelligent, compassionate, faith-based response to problems that arise because of poverty, hunger, lack of justice, and so on.
I would like to see more people become members because the only way that we're going to make our voice heard in Congress is to have it heard in numbers.
A lot of stories about people in there. For example, that at one point this young woman says, hello, Claire Brown, this is Susan Horst. Well, Susan Horst is like today leaving Bread for the World. She's getting in her car and she's driving here because she's going to hike Mount Rainier. She's into mountain climbing and she's finished her term and going to do some graduate work now at the University of Michigan. And The moment in the videotape when I appear, what I'm trying to do is stay awake. I had just gotten back from 3 weeks of field work, and I was physically and mentally and emotionally exhausted. And all of a sudden, I saw that camera, and I thought, I cannot fall asleep while they're videotaping me. This is going to look bad.
Well, you had your eyes open. So.
Yeah, I was working real hard at it. It was a session on South Africa, and the black guy in the picture was from the African National Congress. And the young man who sings the song at the end, Lenny, died in his early 30s, 3 or 4 years ago. And so part of his ongoing contribution to what we do is the song. I'm going to pass around. I have some of the Bread for the World newsletters with me. Let me keep one so I can reference it. And on some other days, I will be handing out other copies of the newsletters related to the topic of the day, related to the Peace Dividend, food stamps, or background papers, or other pieces of material. I have laid out here 4 pieces of material. Your basic membership brochure, which all of you, I'm sure, will want to grab and take home and take some extras for friends. A list of the congressional committees. We use a committee-based strategy, which is to say that the most important stuff does not happen on the floor generally. It happens in the committees. So we work hardest. You have to target somewhere. You can't do everything. So we focus on the congressional committees where most of the action occurs. And if you're interested in what committee your member of Congress is on, you can have that. One of the newsletters I'll hand out later in the week has a voting record for your member of Congress, but it's stapled into the inside and I didn't want to tear them all apart. So we'll just do it that way for those of you here. And I think what I'll do with extras maybe is put them on the table in by the where we worship, so that, you know, if you're out hiking and you want to pick up some materials from the session, you could still get them. Something on how to make your congregation a covenant church, and a basic fact sheet on hunger. How much hunger is there? It's a real nice, simple kind of thing. It's good for Sunday school use or whatever, quick reference. What are some of the basic causes of hunger, and so forth. Well, okay, now at that point, I would like to try to be quiet and let you ask questions, primarily from the videotape, primarily questions about Bread for the World and what we do and that sort of thing. Yes?
I noticed a frequent reference to Bread for the World groups at the local
right.
level. How do those get started? Are there groups, and can you tie into ones that exist in your area?
Yeah. To some extent, it depends. Usually, they're constituted on a metropolitan or a citywide or small town basis. It really varies a lot. I have in Ruston and Monroe, Louisiana, groups that meet once a month, year-round, faithfully. 8 to 12 people get together. They get together. A Bread for the World group does 3 things: worship, study, and action. Someone in the group will design a worship. They will study maybe the issue that's described in the newsletter, or in a background paper. I don't have any background papers here. Well, there's one in the middle of this one. Background paper in the middle of this issue on budget. What's going on with the federal budget this year? And then action usually is to write a letter. I have big cities where 5 people meet. I have little cities where 12 people meet. I mean, really, it's up to the energy level and the interest. I mean, it takes about 2 people to make a Bread for the World group and to make it go. If you've got 3 people that are willing to meet over lunch, over breakfast, in the evening, here in the Northwest, there's a group in Portland, but it's faltering right now. The person who has been the leader is feeling burned out. There has been a group in Gig Harbor. It too is a little in a, these things go through cycles a bit. There are some Presbyterian women in Longview who are very energized about this and trying to get a group to meet on a regular basis there in Longview. And I think they are meeting, in fact. Sometimes Bread for the World groups are in individual congregations. Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Puyallup, Missouri Synod Congregation, has a group that meets once a month on Saturday morning. They have a congregational breakfast together, and they study the issues and write letters and things like that. So you can do it on a congregational level or a city level, and basically it just takes 2 or 3 people who want to make it happen. And one of those basic things is don't expect, you know, people get disappointed. I held a meeting and only 3 people came. When you're doing this kind of work, when you're doing this kind of justice work, and when it requires extra effort on people's parts, and when sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's just work, 3 to 5 people is a good group, is a good sustained group. That's 5 letters. How many letters is your member of Congress going to get on third world debt from your congressional district? You know how many letters they're going to get? They're going to get as many letters as Bread for the World members write, and that's all. Because nobody's paying any attention to third world debt. Nobody pays any attention to food aid. Nobody pays much attention to development policy. There's a lot of stuff that you know, affects millions of people, but you know, we're all busy and you know, we don't know about them. We don't know how to plug into it. We want to do something. We don't know how to plug into it and that sort of thing. So, Seattle, the first congressional district, which is essentially, I don't know, I'm not real clear where the line comes through Seattle. Craig Fiarly has a group there that he's trying to get going, and I'll be with them, what day is this, Monday? I'll be with them 2 weeks from tonight in Seattle. Luther Kriefall has a group in Tacoma. I'll be with them 2 weeks from last night. I'll be in Yakima Sunday morning and Tacoma Sunday evening, 2 weeks from now. And there's a group meets in Yakima, and so forth. So it all kinds of depends on the city. And what I do as an organizer is I go from city to city and church to church. I'll go wherever I can get invited and wherever there's somebody who wants to work on this, you know. And I'll try to work with you. I can give you a printout of how many members are there in your congressional district or in your town. There may be 3 or there may be 300. I mean, it all. And that's it. People don't, like a city like Seattle, you can join Bread for the World and think you're the only member of Bread for the World in the state of Washington, you know. But there's, I don't know, 200-300 members of Bread for the World in Seattle. Yeah, between the 1st and 7th congressional districts. I'd like to get a group going in the 7th congressional district. McDermott is on the House Committee on Banking. And banking processes third world debt and a lot of important stuff. And my impression is he's pretty much generally with us. But you still need to be there generating that grassroots bottom line. Well, as you see, you ask a nice, reasonable question and I give an unreasonably long answer. But what I'm looking for, what I want is not your mind, not your attendance in these sessions. What I want is your soul. That's what I want. I want the center, I want to touch the center of who you are to tell you that you can help people to have decent nutrition. You can help people today, 40,000 people die every day of hunger and hunger-related diseases. Most of those are preventable deaths. Not all of them, I mean, you know. But most of those are preventable deaths. You had your hand up a long time ago. And
probably
so long ago you've forgotten the question.
No, I promised to talk to you about the question, but let me ask the general question.
Sure.
Do you do anything besides work with these groups?
Work with churches?
For
like
example,
what?
For example, I'm concerned that you're lobbying the Congress. Are you also lobbying the media? Because we get our impressions from the media.
Yeah, we work 3, 4, 5 different ways. Local groups, either in congregations or in citywide, or sometimes in a city you can get 2 groups, one in each congressional district. Say, in Seattle, I'd like to get one in the 1st and one in the 7th, if I could pull it off. Right now, there's not the critical mass to do that. We have what we call an offering of letters, an annual one-time letter-writing campaign that churches do across the country. Can generate 50, 100, 150,000 letters. And I'll talk about that one on Wednesday, and we have a kit and material for that. We do media campaigns. We do campus campaigns. We sent out a 3,000 piece mailing to campuses to get campuses going on this stuff. We sent out mailings to all the major newspapers in the country with material about this one topic a year. We can only afford to do, I mean, certain kinds of things you only do once a year just for budget reasons. And we provide materials for you to write a letter to your editor on public policy issues. We'll write the letter for you. You put it in your own words, you use the letter we send you, whatever. You send it in, you mention your member of Congress in the letter to the editor, their staff clips the article and sends it to D.C. We write op-eds, you know, there's the letter to the editor, which is just the little one column thing, you know, maybe this much. And then there's the op-ed. A lot of newspapers have a commentary or local citizens speak out or things like that. And we'll write those for you too on the issues. Because we know you need help. You want to do this, but you just need a lot of help. You know, what our role is to kind of help you get handles on the congressional process, to help you get handles on the issues. So we lobby the media. We train our members to go visit with editorial boards. We have our members visit with their member of Congress. You have a better chance to see your member of Congress than I do. I live in D.C. Most of the year when I'm not traveling, but you have a better chance to see your member of Congress than I do. I came here a week ago, or about not quite a week ago. I drove down to Portland. Congressman Les Aucoin was having a reception. They had had a Select Committee on Hunger hearing. And so they had this reception, and one of my members heard about it, let me know about it, so I called the office and said, can I come to the reception? And I talked to 3 members of Congress that evening. I've never talked to 3 members of Congress before in one day of my life. Where did I talk to them? In Portland, Oregon, not in Washington, D.C. You're their constituents. You're the people they have to listen to. You're the ones that have the power. So we try to work with people to visit with their member of Congress once a year to talk about the issues. So we have a variety of strategies, including media work, yeah. So, how are we doing on time here? Have time for another question. Yes?
What is the present situation for getting food to the starving people of Ethiopia?
The Horn of Africa. Good question. Basically, the government of Ethiopia and the rebels on both sides have been unwilling to let food through. And if food is given to the government, it is withheld from the rebels and used to feed the troops. So that the people who are in the areas of greatest need are not getting the food. What Bread for the World worked for last year, and again this year, is that there would be a guarantee, an international guarantee of safe passage for trucks of food that would be trucked in over the border. A lot of that food is distributed by Catholic Relief and Lutheran World Relief. And if Lutheran World Relief doesn't just distribute Lutheran money, it wouldn't be enough to do much. A lot of that food that is distributed goes through the church agencies, because they're the ones that have grassroots contacts. The U.S. government only deals with other governments, by and large, sometimes with other organizations, but largely with governments. So, and about, 6 weeks ago, as a matter of fact, they agreed to a temporary truce, and they were able to get some trucks across the northern border and into the people in greatest need. But that's a kind of day-to-day basis. I mean, the trucks can get through today and they can start shooting them tomorrow. And you just can't do a whole lot about that. One of the primary causes of hunger is not drought. It is war. Drought factors in, but we've got enough food to feed everybody. Quantity of food is not the problem. It's getting it to people in places like the Horn of Africa.
It's true in El Salvador, too.
El Salvador also, yeah. Yes, take your question and then we've got to quit. You're going to need a break and there's another session in a little bit.
The people that we saw in the video who Bread for the World were pretty middle and upper class, upper middle. Do you enlist the hungry themselves in the lobbying and in the work, and what is their part in, you're doing this on their behalf, but
right.
What part do they have in
right.
the actual work?
We have a few local groups comprised primarily of poor and marginal people. We work very hard at inclusivity on racial, ethnic, gender lines. We're very intentional about that stuff. But that still doesn't necessarily mean poor. We have not reached well into direct involvement of poor people. Not as much as we would like.
Thinking of the numbers there, and the numbers are important.
It's hard. See, poor people basically don't believe in the system. The system doesn't work for them. If you think writing a letter doesn't make a difference, you can imagine what somebody who's on the streets thinks, you know. I'll tell you this, one little short story and then we'll quit. We did a campaign on the WIC program a couple of years ago, and we got some WIC directors, Women, Infants, Children's Supplemental Food Program, to get some of the clients to write letters. They'd come in for their food, and they would, while they were there, just say, "Dear Representative so-and-so, I'm on WIC, and without that food, my baby wouldn't eat." Something like that. I mean, just something real simple. It doesn't have to be elegant. You don't have to tell them about the bill. They know about the bill. Just tell them what you think. One of our staff was later in the home of one of those WIC recipients. And you know, you get back these usually form letters, which is okay. I mean, you don't want your member of Congress sitting there writing individual letters to everybody who writes. You know, they count them. They know what's going on. And they had taken that letter and framed it and put it on the wall.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really touching.